Theodore Roosevelt unexpectedly became president of the United States in 1901 when President McKinley was assassinated. He made conservation a top priority and established many new national parks, forests, and monuments intended to preserve the nation's natural resources. David Gessner looks at that legacy in his new book, Leave It As It Is, A Journey Through Theodore Roosevelt's American Wilderness. Welcome back.
Thanks, Mindy. Good to be back.
So tell us how the idea for the book came about.
Well, a few things kind of came together, and one was that I had been, you know, after I left Massachusetts when I was 30, which we've talked about before, I had testicular cancer. I was living in Worcester, and I wrote in my journal, I don't know what's worse, cancer or Worcester. Sorry to you Worcesterites in the audience. And I moved out to Colorado and started up my life again there. And at that time, I started to explore southeast Utah quite a lot, and the ruins there, and the Anasazi ruins and dwellings, and really fell in love with it. So in 2016, I was asked by a group, was putting together an anthology called Red Rock Testimony, to contribute to it. And I called myself the token Easterner. It was a lot of Native voices and Western voices. And that book was distributed to all the members of Congress and became part of the campaign to make Bears Ears a national monument in southeast Utah. And when, in December of 2016, on his way out of office, Obama declared it a national monument, it was one of those few moments where kind of your personal and political lives come together, and I felt really empowered. I felt a little less so 9 months later when then-Secretary of Interior Ryan Zinke, Trump's Interior Secretary, undeclared the land. And he did so standing in front of a portrait of Teddy Roosevelt on Roosevelt, what would have been Roosevelt's 159th birthday, and claiming he was a Roosevelt Republican. So I'd already been studying the Antiquities Act because of the work I did for the anthology. But at that moment, it all kind of came together. And yeah. I was pretty upset by what had happened. I had already been studying it, and and Roosevelt was right there. And I said, if I'm going to become a fighter and not just a writer about nature, what better model than TR? And so yeah. I launched the book proposal within a couple of weeks and headed out west for a scouting mission in January of 2018, and then did the summer-long trip following the footsteps of Roosevelt that next summer.
Yeah, and you brought your nephew with you.
I did. He was a good kind of, straight man, basically. 21 years old, just out of college, never had been west before. So it was kind of like reliving that moment for me.
A lot of people don't really understand maybe the significance of Bears Ears. And you write, the important thing was that there was one difference between Bears Ears National Monument and all the other national monuments that came before it. It was the first national monument to fully grow out of the thinking, support, and political power of Native American tribes.
Right, and that's crucial to the book. The Antiquities Act was created in 1906. And the very first national monument was what Native people called Bear's Lodge, but we call Devil's Tower from Close Encounters. You probably remember it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an example of using the Antiquities Act to basically claim Native land. So there was always something a little fishy about this process, and certainly Roosevelt himself was a little suspect when it came to his views of Native peoples. So this was this beautiful thing that I discovered during that scouting mission in January of 2018. The first person I interviewed was Regina Lopez White Skunk, a member of the Mountain Ute tribe. And she described to me how they had decided to take Native land that was the meeting ground of five tribes, and they were going to use our tools, our government tools, for their purposes. They were going to use the Antiquities Act to claim this land that was chock full of antiquities and dwellings as a national monument. And mm-hmm. So it was this beautiful thing where you had the best of kind of our national park ideal and national monument ideal and a confluence of that with this Native ideal. And so that's what was so exhilarating about it. It was like telling a new story about a public land. And that's why it was so depressing, too, when it was torn away. 85% of it was taken away.
Right. And even more depressing when you look at how they split it up, right? I mean, it was more than a slap in the face.
Right. And the decision to call it Bear's Ears, you know, the five tribes were the Hopi, the Ute, the Zuni, the Mountain Ute, and the Navajo, who were the real drivers. And they decided not to name it by any of their particular names. But each tribe in their own language called it Bear's Ears, because when you're up there, you can't mistake the two Bear's Ears when you see them, which I camped below and climbed. But the decision by Trump also was to rename the little broken up parts in one in Navajo. And you could just feel that sense of something has come together and become a whole, and we're trying to fracture it and split it apart. And you know, that's another kind of motivation for writing the book. I have so many writer, intellectual friends who were kind of reacting almost knee-jerk day-to-day to whatever Donald Trump had done the day before. And I was feeling the same way early in his presidency, but I wanted to do a long, kind of thoughtful, deep dive rebuttal in a subject that I knew a lot about, which was the natural world.
Yeah. Now, you couldn't have known just how timely this book would be. The Museum of Natural History decides to take down the statue of President Roosevelt, which has been criticized as a symbol of colonialism and racism. And then the Sierra Club removes a monument, the monuments of the founder, John Muir, over his racist history. This is all coming about, you know, as the book comes out.
And don't forget Yosemite or Yosemite as well.
Right. Right.
Alice, his daughter, said of him, "My father always wanted to be the bride at every wedding, the corpse at every funeral, and the baby at every christening." And he that's a kind of superficial overlap with Trump. He loved attention. And it's amazing how much attention Roosevelt has gotten in the last month, not just the statue and John Muir being semi-canceled, but Trump saying, and this is his, I believe the exact words were, "I'm the same or almost as good a conservationist as Roosevelt."
So, and you touch on the racism in the book, but that isn't the main focus of the book. And as our eyes are opened to history we may not have heard before, it really becomes hard to ignore, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I do, you know, at one point in the book, because I always try to have a little bit of humor in there, I actually stage a fistfight between our current president and Roosevelt, in which I think, other than sheer mass, Roosevelt would have the advantage. But the differences between the two are what really define them. And the more I dug into Roosevelt, you know, I didn't want to make any excuses for where he was behind his times, but he was ahead of his times environmentally, and he was always a grower. You know, he would read a book a night, he listened to people as well as monologued, and by the end, when he came back, Ryan as a Bull Moose candidate, his platform was one that would have made Bernie blush. It was against the elite criminal class. It was for the poor. It was supportive of women's rights and minorities. And of course, he was a big trust buster as well and fought against monopolies. And I like to think that he would do a good job of fighting the fossil fuel industry right now.
All right, let's talk about the buffalo. As you venture into the Badlands National Park in South Dakota, you are reminded that at one time there were millions of buffalo in the 1860s, and by 1902, 23 left in the wild.
Can you believe that?
I know, it's amazing. It's like the passenger pigeon, right? It's like there are millions and then there are none, right?
Yeah. And, it was a conscious effort by the government, too, because they knew that native people depended on the buffalo. So people were encouraged to shoot them from the trains and to encourage to let them rot right out there on the plains.
Terrible.
And, Roosevelt, here's another example where he's not a simple character. He's messy and hypocritical, and certainly he was eager to shoot a buffalo when he got out west. But, he shot maybe a couple dozen where the slaughter was in the millions, and he eventually came around to deeply regretting the fact that the Badlands was not only without buffalo, but without big carnivores, and his environmental conscience kind of evolved. I say in the book that he had many prejudices, but But one prejudice he did not have, that a lot of us have, is anthropocentrism. You know, he could see beyond just the human, and he could see ecosystems, and he could see animals and trees. And that is pretty unique in American presidents.
Yeah. So tell us about his role in saving the buffalo.
Well, as I say, he came out, and in a way, his role at first was against saving the buffalo because he was a rancher. And eventually what would happen when all those buffalo that you mentioned went away, they would be replaced by everybody's favorite, the cow. And the wild realm became the realm of the cow. But he eventually, particularly at Yellowstone and in other further western places, began to see how just devoid of joy and hope and wildness these places were without the big animals. And so he was involved in the zoo in New York. He was involved in saving some last wild buffalo in Yellowstone. And, you know, when people talk about Yellowstone, they always talk about the arch and for the enjoyment and pleasure of the people. But I always feel like Roosevelt's secret agenda wasn't really for the people, because only 2% of the park is, you know, where the people go. 98% is the realm of the buffalo and now the grizzly and the mountain lions and the wolves. And this was a president who grew up wanting not to be a statesman or a soldier, but he wanted to be a working naturalist like his hero Charles Darwin. So he always kind of was, you know, he could be fighting in Cuba, getting ready to charge up San Juan Hill, and some turkey vultures would fly over, and he'd start taking field notes on them. And I love the kind of multitasking element of Roosevelt. One of my favorite stories is these boat thieves steal his little boat when he's in the Badlands, and they go racing off down the Little Missouri. He and his ranch hands build a boat and chase after them through this river choked full of ice, you know, in the middle of winter. And on the way out the door, he grabs Anna Karenina. And while he's not chasing down the boat thieves, he's reading Tolstoy. Part of the reason I was like, wow, this intellectual, athletic, wild man in a lot of ways, and who said being president was pure fun.
Well, yeah, I think he's the only president who ever said it was pure fun, right?
Yeah.
But let's back up and look at his childhood. He was a frail child with a powerful father. So talk about the role of his father's influence in his transformation.
Well, they called his father Greatheart, you know, and he was this philanthropic. He was one of the founders of the American Museum of Natural History, which, to go back to your earlier comment, I think that all the Roosevelts would agree that maybe that statue needs to come down. And we got to remember that in a compensating gesture, the museum is renaming its Hall of Biodiversity after Roosevelt. But he was this big figure, and he was religious in a way that Teddy wasn't. You know, he believed in muscular Christianity, no more meek little Jesus. This, you know, was more like Arnold Schwarzenegger as Jesus picture. So Teddy was frail. He had asthma, sickly. His dad, in the spirit of the times or in the way of the times, would take him on coach rides through the country and would blow cigar smoke on him, supposedly to help his lungs. But his dad also said the words that really kind of changed his life. He took Teddy aside and said, "You have the mind, but you don't have the body. You've got to make your body." And I was kind of at that point, I think you cue up Rocky, you know, a montage, and Teddy starts lifting weights like crazy and calisthenics and boxing, and eventually this scrawny kid becomes this burly man. And that only increases when he goes out to the Badlands and he can be in the saddle for 24 hours and he's hunting and he's working on the ranch. So that moment, you know, his dad dies when he's in his 40s, when his dad is in his 40s. But that, I feel like the whole life was kind of living up to the dad and proving himself to the dad. And I always say that he wasn't as religious as his father, but the father's muscular Christianity became his muscular environmentalism.
Yeah, and he was a birder. You write, for this eventual author of 47 books, the beginning of his writing life was directly tied to birds and nature. This passion was there from the beginning, and it would stay with him until the end. While president, he would famously rush into a cabinet meeting with important news and ask his expectant cabinet, gentlemen, do you know what has happened this morning? They did not, so he told them, just now I saw a chestnut-sided warbler, and it's only February.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I love the way it's all tied to birds. You know, I mentioned that he wanted to be a naturalist, but a really big moment when the writing started was when his family, you know, he had a wealthy family, and they went down the Nile in a boat, and he had just gotten two presents that would change his life. The first was a pair of glasses. The world had been very blurry for him before that. He's 14 years old. He gets a pair of glasses, and he gets a rifle. And unfortunately, like Audubon before him and like birders of the time, he killed a lot of what he studied. But he also delighted in birdsong. The Western meadowlark was his favorite. And he preferred American birds, not surprisingly, to European birds. But his early jottings in his journal, which I was lucky enough to see at the Houghton Museum and Library, I mean, Houghton Library at Harvard, you know, his jottings are all about the birds, and the writing starts to come from the birds and will lead to books and books and books. You know, the whole time this guy is going on adventures, the whole time he's president, he's putting out books at an incredible pace until, you know, there are 47 books by the end. And Even later, we know about him going down the River of Doubt in the Amazon. I always think of him as kind of a reality show unto himself. He goes on these trips and does these wild things, and then at the end of the day, he types them up. So it's like he's got this self-conscious aspect to it, too, where he's doing these things, he's throwing himself into these things, and then he's writing about them.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the meadowlark, and when you and your nephew Noah were in the Badlands, you note that you got serenaded by that same bird that serenaded Teddy Roosevelt 130 years earlier. What was that like? I mean, were you conscious of that as you were listening to the meadowlark going, just like Teddy, I'm listening to the meadowlark?
Well, I hadn't been out west in a little while, so I didn't recognize it immediately, but pretty quickly I did, and I saw it. And then, you know, it's all, you know, I just, as you can tell from past books, I like kind of communing with the dead, you know, talking to ghosts. And there are moments when you're exploring these lives where it's so exciting, and you're, you know, one of the reasons I was in the Badlands, which if you haven't been there, you know, is just this, it's like Utah in a way, but it's even stranger. The colors are stranger in the rock forms. And of course, Noah, who hadn't been there, hadn't been west, said that the approach from the east through what he called the boring Midwest, again, no offense, suddenly we dropped into this crazy, twisting rock roller coaster, basically. You know, I love being in those places that they were, and I really feel that it's a great way to write about people, to go where they were.
Yeah.
You know, and also, you know, we're in the midst of, you mentioned John Muir, who I could do a whole show on in terms of where he's guilty of some of these things they're accusing him, but where some of the accusations are a little flimsy. But it's hard to be even-handed right now because we, you know, we're in the cancel culture where we feel like it's an either-or thing. And yeah. I don't go to these biographical subjects to either. I'm not St. Peter. I'm not judging whether they go to heaven or hell, right?
Yeah.
I go to them to learn things and to, as my old professor Walter Jackson Bates said, to see what I can put to use in my own life. And you discard and you judge, you know, you say, okay, that's a bad thing, and you judge it perhaps. But you can also see the good in there, too. And that's not a popular stance at the moment in this world.
Right. Yeah. We're talking with David Gessner. His new book is A Journey, Leave It As It Is, A Journey Through Theodore Roosevelt's American Wilderness. And we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with David Gessner. His new book is Leave It As It Is, A Journey Through Theodore Roosevelt's American Wilderness. Tell us about Medora, North Dakota. You describe it as a Theodore Roosevelt theme park.
Yeah, and there's no doubt who Mickey Mouse is in that Disney world. And it was just, you know, we had just been in the Badlands. We woke up one morning with a buffalo nibbling grass pretty near our tent, which was crazy for me and especially crazy for Noah. Noah, as I mentioned in the book, doesn't talk much. In that way, he's quite different than me. But that got his attention, the buffalo. So from there, we drove to Medora, which is where Roosevelt landed when he first moved and started his ranch in the Badlands. And right away, you could tell you were in some kind of alternate universe, where in the bar where we had lunch, this stockbroker and this motorcyclist, biker, were telling Teddy Roosevelt stories to each other. And then on the way to our campground, we pulled into a building that looked like a museum. It had a big signature of Roosevelt on the side, but turned out to be kind of a worker's support for the summer workers at Medora. And on the way to the bathroom, we ran into Teddy Roosevelt. And he was dressed as Teddy. He spoke like Teddy. Edith was with him and his son, Quentin. And we got into we told them all the stories about our trip so far, how we'd been to Sagamore Hill and we'd been to D.C. and to Harvard. And he recited the Leave It As It Is speech, the Grand Canyon speech for us. And actually, that was a couple of years ago. And when I started to do these talks for the book recently, I was like, hey, I'm going to find out who that guy was. And I tracked him down, and his name is Larry Marple. He's a professional Roosevelt imitator. So now when I do the bookstore talks, I'll start for 10 minutes, and then Teddy Roosevelt will barge in and start talking. And we're quite competitive in terms of who likes to talk more. I can't go on 4 hours like he did sometimes during.
Oh, my, yeah. And I think, when you think about when Teddy Roosevelt headed west, there was a lot of sadness in his life. And I guess it goes back to that, that will and determination. We talked about how he transformed from this frail child into this really kind of, outdoor manly man. But he had a lot of sadness in, losing his wife. And it's really kind of amazing to at how he overcame that.
He was 24 years old, and in the course of a day, he lost his mother and his wife. His dad had already died. So, when we think of the story of him going to the Badlands, it's kind of this exhilarating, the biographies that came out in the late 70s, Edmund Morris's biography and David McCullough's, kind of are about this young man transforming and becoming larger and becoming the Roosevelt we know. But there was something else going on out there, too, because, as you say, he had just suffered these losses where he would never in print mention his wife's name again. And I feel like he was exorcising, a lot of demons out there. So when he stayed out camping, sleeping on the ground for days in a row, or when he stayed in the saddle and drove cattle for days, I feel like a lot of what was going on is just kind of trying to drive out thought and anxiety and sadness. I'm going to get the quote a little wrong, but I think his famous quote was, "Black care never sits behind a rider who rides fast enough." So he kind of believed, and Churchill had a little of that too with his black dog, these hyperkinetic personalities who do so much. You're kind of like, well, why aren't they sitting still?
Exactly. Yeah, because they probably would shrivel up and die if they sat still, right?
Yep. The other thing I didn't know before writing the book was that he started the second he woke up and went all day, and he drank cup after cup of coffee in this large saucer-like cup until as Edmund Morris put it, he would go to sleep energetically, that night. And he coined the term "good to the last drop" that
So, one of the interesting things I thought in the book was about our misconceptions of just what public lands mean.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, they're all different sorts, right? And especially in the West, it's funny because BLM, which is a very popular abbreviation right now, until recently in the West, it meant Bureau of Land Management. And the Bureau of Land Management, which is much more well-known west of the Mississippi, manages a lot of land where it leases out land to ranchers, leases out land to be grazed by cows, and leases it out cheaply. so to the point where people have referred to a lot of Western land that's cows are kind of marauding over and excreting on and chewing up and leaving cow burnt, as the phrase goes. They've referred to that land as kind of a beautiful, rugged welfare state. And the recipients of that welfare are the famous individualists, the cowboys, which was something, even though Roosevelt started as a rancher, he began to recognize. And the great writer from the mid-20th century, Bernard DeVoto, who I quote quite a bit in the chapter called The Cowboy Problem, he called these ranchers out on it, on destroying the environment. He said their half of their land goes sludging down the Mississippi into the Gulf. And he had a famous phrase where you know, you got these rugged cowboys saying, "We hate the government." His phrase was, "Get out and give us money." You know, you can't have it both ways. So there's been an effort. So, for instance, even within the National Monument, even with Bears Ears before it was reduced, you have a lot of this BLM land where it's being, it's fine with small ranchers, but it's also now corporations and multi-million dollar outfits that take advantage of this cheap leasing. So it's complicated out there.
Yeah,
there are lands that, you know, you just really, in this age of climate change and with everything kind of reduced, I have environmental friends in the West who say the ultimate solution is kind of a large-scale zoning where we say, okay, this is the place where you guys can use your ATVs. This is, you know, this is the recreation place. Because, of course, recreation culture has its own pernicious effects on the landscape. And this is the place where we're going to leave it as it is, you know.
Right,
There need to be places like that. I mean, what we're going through right now, you know, it would have been a good idea to leave the bats as they were. And it's what we're going through right now. We need these places that are kind of our Noah's Arks for the future and where things continue to evolve and things are, you know, we also need to be stewards of some places, but the idea of leaving it as it is one that excites my imagination. And a year after my travels with Noah, I flew over the West in a two-seater plane and, you know, flew a big lap around Colorado, Wyoming, Montana. And there was some depressing stuff, seeing the beetle kill and things like that. But the overall effect of seeing, of being able to travel for 35 minutes in a plane without seeing a human being, and space, which is still out there in the West, the increased population, is a hopeful thing. Wallace Stegner called it the geography of hope. And so we got to hold on to that hopeful thing. And the other thing about it is, until very recently, it has been both a liberal and conservative issue. It's been our common ground, literally. You know, after the Civil War, when we were more fractured than we are now, the public lands and increasing the parks and the national monuments it was an issue that both sides of the aisle embraced. So, we see it a little bit in the Great American Outdoors Act, and hopefully we see it more in the future, where people are just like, hey, if this wasn't America's best idea, it was a pretty good idea, and it's one we got to hold on to.
Yeah. And I had not realized cows came with the Europeans, and, I mean, how much you know, they do to the environment. It makes sense that they are not the greatest thing, but I didn't realize how much damage they actually do. But tell us about the Y2Y project. This is really interesting. It's really interesting.
Thinking,
yeah.
I was thinking about that when you just said that. The Y2Y project is spearheaded really by some Canadian environmentalists. Harvey Locke is one of them. And the idea was, parks are wonderful, but parks, in a way, are islands. And as biologists say, islands are where species go to die, simply because conservation biologists say that, because they're locked in. You know, they can't move beyond that island. So the idea of Y2Y was to start in Yellowstone and connect it to Banff and connect it to the Yukon, but have these big segments of park that were connected by corridors. And of course, to work with ranchers and farmers nearby, so they're not the environmental enemy. And they did this, and they made overpasses and underpasses under highways for large animals to migrate through. And it's been stunningly successful. And what a lot of Western environmentalists are thinking of, and this kind of comes back to like E.O. Wilson's Half Earth, that rather than, you know, save what we got, we've got to save more, we've got to increase. The idea is connecting, say, Yellowstone to the south. You know, what if you could create a pathway from the Grand Canyon to Yellowstone? And it's not as unfeasible as it sounds. I mean, there are ways up through Utah, through Bear's Ears, in fact, where there are these big swaths of saved land. And, you know, if you start doing that, something miraculous happens, which is evolution. You have the old migrations, and you have this health return that you can't have with little islands of saved land.
We are talking with David Gessner. His new book is Leave It As It Is, A Journey Through Theodore Roosevelt's American Wilderness. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with David Gessner. His new book is Leave It As It Is, A Journey Through Theodore Roosevelt's American Wilderness. Let's talk about your experience in Yellowstone. Buffalo and elk herds are nothing compared to the car herds.
Yeah. Well, as anybody who's been there knows, those wilderness traffic jams are pretty pretty depressing at times, even if the people up front in the line are seeing a grizzly. And Noah and I did see grizzly bears, the first ones he's ever seen, but we had to push our way through a crowd to see them. And I think it was in the book I wrote about Edward Abbey and Wallace Stegner that I talked to Doug Peacock, who was the original grizzly man. He's Hayduke for people in the West who know the sign Hayduke lives. And when I moaned and groaned about Yellowstone, he said, "You're talking about a tiny sliver of the park. You're not take." Go half a mile off these roads, and suddenly you're in the realm of bear. And you're if you're saying wilderness doesn't exist, suddenly you're a little scared, and you think, "Oh, hey, there's real wilderness here," and there is. It's like there are packs of wolves, there are grizzly bears, the mountain lions have reintroduced themselves. So you have what Roosevelt was doing, and what has been done. You can look at it cynically and roll your eyes, and I do at times when you're in line at a tourist stop, you know, in the middle of Yellowstone Village. But if you're out there a little bit, and if you go off the beaten track, you've got this huge ecosystem that is fraught with danger. You know, there are a lot of challenges still, but it's pretty exciting to think that that was done. An interesting side note in terms of east versus west, even the Grand Canyon, where Roosevelt's saying, leave it as it is, the thing that a lot of people who wanted to save land had in mind was Niagara Falls. It was already a kitschy tourist trap kind of place, and the idea was, we don't want it to be like that. So, you know, a lot of the creation of the parks where they tried to save large swaths of land were, we don't want it to go down that route. And to some extent it has, you know, and I roll my eyes at a lot of this stuff, but there's still real wildness there.
Yeah. And you don't talk about this in the book, but I'm thinking when you mentioned the wolves, as the wolf population declined, we saw a real change in the environment, right? And then the wolves come back, and it makes you think about that whole ecosystem, which Teddy Roosevelt really had an eye for. But when you take a species away from an ecosystem, it has a tremendous impact.
Yeah, and that's right. He saw that in a way. You know, he was, you know, obviously we have leadership now that doesn't trust scientists. This was a leader who was a scientist, or at least a naturalist. And naturalists, you know, I've been on this show a few times, and, you know, one time maybe for my book, Sick of Nature, and I've resisted and kind of screamed and yelled a little bit about being called a nature writer. I want to say I'm a writer, not a nature writer, but now I'm starting to embrace it. In this time of climate change and pandemic, I'm like, yeah, maybe that's a good thing to be, because it's about connecting things and realizing connections and realizing that if you can't pull this out of the system without impacting 100 other things. And I think Roosevelt knew that. I mean, it's not every president that in the middle of his presidency goes out and spends a day in Yellowstone studying and counting elk.
Now, interesting history to what we think or have thought about wilderness and who inhabits it, right? I mean, you think of wilderness as there's no humans there, but that is not the case.
Yeah, and in fact, we've gotten some evidence in the last couple months that the human inhabitation of this continent might have been twice as long as we imagined. And before disease, you know, it was much more heavily populated than we imagined. That was a different kind. It depended on the region. You know, the Cape Indians were different than the Yellowstone Indians. But there was a general sense of migration and nomadic moving to the good places when it was good, you know, coming to the coast in the summer. You know, we're not the first ones to go to Cape Cod in the summer. But it was still a populated, not heavily populated country. And so there was something, I agree with the people who critique the Muir Roosevelt idea of wanting to return it to pristine, empty wilderness, because it was an empty wilderness. And Yellowstone was put aside, but it had been Native American hunting grounds. But it's a complicated, it's not an either or, because much of the land that was put aside, it wasn't a choice between a native paradise and a park. It was a choice between a developed, you know, probably condo units now and a park. Because in many things, it wasn't always contemporaneous. It wasn't, the land had already been taken from the native people and it was reclaimed as a park. So it's a little more complicated, but I think we have to remember that the wilderness that we celebrate is kind of from a romantic sense was somebody's home.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about Gifford Pinchot. Is that how you say his name? I'm not sure how you say
Pinchot,
his last name.
Yeah.
Pinchot, yeah. Tell us a little about him. That's interesting.
Yeah, so he's the director of the Forest Service and what will be the interior, and he is a pragmatist. He's gone to Europe to study forest management, and nobody, you know, is really thinking of, everybody's just thinking, oh, this is an inexhaustible resource we have. And though he's known as kind of a wise use, later that term was mangled during the James Watt era and stuff, but if somebody who wanted to use our resources, he wanted to use them in a sane and reasoned and planned out way. So he becomes kind of, I guess you'd put Roosevelt in the middle, Muir on the more radical left, and Pinchot on the right. And Roosevelt's kind of torn between that kind of pragmatic ideal of using our resources and the more preservationist ideal of Muir. But as I write in the book, and I'm not going to be able to pull the exact stat off, but at one point I say, if Pinchot hadn't come in when he did, we would have essentially cut down all our trees within a decade. Mm-hmm. I mean, before, you know, he's not a favorite figure of environmentalists, but without him and without him putting the brakes on things, we were just like paving the whole country. So even though he is perceived as unenvironmental in some ways, he was a bit of a savior, and he really worked. Roosevelt looked to him as his favorite of his cabinet members, not personally, because he was kind of cold and austere, but practically. And they would work together, like the famous moment where Congress passed a bill where there could be no more national reserves. And before Roosevelt signed it, he huddled up with Pinchot and saved a couple more million acres. And I don't know if that number's right, but it was some absurd amount of land they saved. And then he signed the bill and said, okay, there you go.
Yeah. You write, as well as creating 5 national parks and 18 national monuments, he set aside 51 federal bird reserves and 4 national game preserves, and of course the United States Forest Service and 150 national forests. He did so relentlessly in the face of much criticism from people who didn't just question what he was doing, but could barely comprehend the why of it. And he did it while opposing the most powerful commercial and corporate interest of his time. He did it in the face of an increasingly reluctant Congress. This wasn't easy for him.
No, and he was creating the arena in which it was being fought. I mean, this was a new. I mean, certainly parks had been saved before, but this was a new thing, and it was one of his top three priorities as president. I mean, imagine that. Even environmental presidents don't really. It's always like number 12 or something on the list of priorities. Yeah. And I just, I can't help but think, again, granting all the flaws he had, I can't help but think he would be the perfect climate change president. The belief in science, the willingness to fight the powers, he was called a traitor to his class. The way he would take on the railroads and the monopolies would be the same way he'd take on the fossil fuel industries. And then, and this is really important, we've never really gotten our heads around the way to use our language to describe the climate fight. It's a much, it's a lot easier to say, don't cut down these trees, leave it as it is. And what do you say? What's the like phrase for climate change, And in a weird way, the rough draft of climate change is the way we've been living the last 6 months, right? Is travel less, study your backyard, don't use as many resources. But I feel like he was really good at taking these concepts, digesting them, and then bringing them back to people in inspiring ways. And he was a brave politician who wasn't a poll watcher. It would be really interesting to see if we had an inspiring leader, whether we could really face the climate fight in a way we haven't at all.
A lot of people think that Teddy Roosevelt created the Antiquities Act, but not so.
Right. Congress created it, but Congress might not have known what they were doing to some extent. It was kind of a fascinating story on the way it made its way through Congress, but it's a long story. So the short version is that the country was becoming enamored of native sites, then called, like Anasazi ruins and Anasazi dwellings, and Mesa Verde being one of the more famous ones. And meanwhile, some European museums and European explorers started to ship these antiquities overseas. And we didn't like that. And so there started to be this kind of movement toward protecting them. But in the language of the act, it says, I believe, it is up to the discretion of the president. And in the book I say, the word discretion with this particular president, they don't really go together. And so originally I think Congress conceived of saving much smaller bits of land with the antiquities on them. Roosevelt would go bigger and bigger the way he always did until he was saving 800,000 acres in the Grand Canyon, which also set a precedent because that would soon become a national park. So to some degree, these Antiquities Act proclamations that became national monuments were a stepping stone to national parks. And Bears Ears, which is, was until recently, million acres plus, is so chock full of antiquities. You can barely go for a hike without seeing thousand-year-old dwellings and a civilization that was there before. So even though it's a large amount of land, it seems to me the very definition of the Antiquities Act.
Yeah, you're right. What I am trying to say is that Bears Ears offered and still offers a possibility that by doing this right and doing it now, we have a chance not to just save some land, but to put forward no less than a new wilderness ideal. It's an ideal that imagines both a large wilderness and an inclusive one, an ideal of the land not separate from people. Nature is not an island or a zoo or a setting for a reality show, but a place for humans, not apart from them. And if these humans happen to be indigenous people, all the better.
Right. I mean, I say later on in the book that, Roosevelt's vision and Muir's vision of saving land and putting it aside and leaving it as it is was not perfect. And one of the flaws clearly was in their attitudes toward the native people who'd had the land. But it was a really good rough draft. And now it's up to us in the present moment to take it and, you know, refine it and revise it and make it an inspiring story now. And to me, Bear Gears seemed to do that. And, you know, people will say, well, how can you be saying this when, you know, we're barely holding on to the land we have and you're talking about expanding? And I guess I would say, in a sort of Rooseveltian spirit, that large challenges excite us. You know, it's not always you do the little thing and that's, you know, that's not what gets the momentum going. I think the right politician, the right leader could excite us in terms of, this is a way forward. This is treating land as that Noah's Ark, treating land as a place that's the best thing about us. It's pretty thrilling. And when you're out there in it, it's particularly thrilling. So I love the idea of that, you know, the tribes will still go to Bear's Ears for medicinal plants, that they'll go for ceremony. I was lucky enough to be at the Bear's Ears celebration in the summer of 2018, which was in the meadows right below Bear's Ears, which had been where tribes had traded and met from hundreds of miles away for thousands of years. And that was a really exciting moment, the kind of, this is our land. This is their land, and it's our land. And it got me to write a book. So,
you know, yeah, and you talk about, you know, a political, you know, political leaders who could embrace this vision like Teddy Roosevelt did. But don't you think it takes more than that? I mean, when you think about how divisive our country has become, it seems impossible to get anything, any kind of consensus on things. So I guess, what is it that you're hoping people will take away from the book?
Well, you know, I've written books about much smaller chunks of land, like the Charles River and the Cape. And I think the small fights are part of the larger fights. Realistically and somewhat cynically, lawyers are very helpful. You know, in this Trump era, when we see him going after everything, at the very least, they hold the line for a little bit. But I do hold out hope of a politician. One thing Roosevelt did, I mean, he was considered kind of warlike, bellicose, but he never started a war. And I mentioned in the book that I would listen to books on tape on the way and Roosevelt speeches, and Noah got really sick of the phrase manly vigor. But he did have manly vigor. And I could imagine a politician of either party, though probably not a Republican at the moment, but who had some Western roots but cared about land, who could present this in a way where there was more popular support for it. Because the popular support is there. If you read polls about public lands and parks, it's there in both parties. So I do hold out hope that there could be leaders. But meanwhile, there are plenty of small fights. Things turn in November, Bear's Ears may be, you know, reinstated by Biden. But that opens up a whole other can of worms, which is, right now, there's a case in the District of Columbia courtroom where the fate of the Antiquities Act is kind of being decided. And the main question is, can one president undo what a previous president has done? Mm-hmm. And hopefully they're going to say no and rule what happened in Bear's Ears illegal. If they were to say yes, you would have, you know, the flip-flopping of declaring and undeclaring that would go on ad nauseum, and that would just, it makes no sense. Yeah. So I do feel like I'm hopeful in this book, in part because I'm out there in these beautiful landscapes, but I'm a realist, and it's dark times for sure. And I guess my little area of non-cynical hope is often tied to nature and the land.
David Gessner's new book, Leave It As It Is, A Journey Through Theodore Roosevelt's American Wilderness. Thanks, David, for being with us. Appreciate your
time. Thanks, Mindy. I love being here.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.